Hello, and welcome to another edition of Out of Sight XYZ, the international award-winning program featuring information for the blind community from the blind community. I'm Vince Lombardi, and over the next hour, Jason Rufo will be your host as we travel to the studios of WGBH, Boston's public broadcasting affiliate. For over 30 years, the Media Access Group, a division of WGBH, has strived to make television, movies, and other forms of media accessible to people with sensory disabilities. Pioneers of many adaptive technologies, including closed captioning, DVS, and MOPIX, the group remains committed to making pre-existing and emerging media platforms accessible to everyone. On today's program, Jason will take you inside the descriptive video division of the Media Access Group. The division's mission is to make television programs, films, home videos, and other visual media accessible to the sight impaired. We will hear from Ira Miller, Video Description Operations Manager, and Mary Watkins, Outreach and Communications Director for the Media Access Group. Both will provide us with an overview of descriptive video service, how it's changed over the years, and what to expect for the future. Later, we will be joined by Brian Gould, a DVS describer, who will explain the intricacies and challenges of writing audio descriptions. Finally, Sheila Ray Lau, a post-production supervisor, will share her thoughts with us and discuss the steps involved in producing and editing DVS projects. All that and much more coming up on this edition of Out of Sight XYZ. Now here's Jason with our first two guests, Ira Miller and Mary Watkins.
Ira, we're going to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what your position entails here at WGBH?
I'm the operations manager for Descriptive Video Service here in the Boston office, and my job is to sort of quarterback the team of describers and post-production supervisors to make sure everything runs smoothly and we get out as much audio description on programming as possible.
Sounds great. And Mary, how about yourself? Give us a little background on you.
I am the Outreach and Communications Director for the Media Access Group here at WGBH. So my work entails getting the word out on what we caption and describe. So not only do I do that with sort of targeted traditional audiences, people who are deaf or blind, but also people who may be just losing their sight, people who use captioning perhaps as a literacy tool if they're just learning to read or learning English. And we're also trying to get the word out to mainstream audiences. So perhaps think about people who have a family member, a parent or a child with a disability who may not personally be affected by the services now or need them, but actually are important means of us getting information out about these services.
Well, in general, what's the primary mission of the Media Access Group and how long has the group been here for?
The Media Access Group has been in existence since the early 70s. It originally came out of the Caption Center, which is our service area that makes TV, films, videos, DVDs accessible to people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And since then, we developed Descriptive Video Service. That was about 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And then we now have a research and development division to take those two services, captioning and description, and really apply them to new media formats and new media platforms, whether that be classroom materials for children who are mainstreamed, movie theaters, DVDs. We're going on to all kinds of new projects because, as you know, media platforms are just proliferating at an unbelievable speed. So we try to keep up and we also try to anticipate where the barriers are going to come so we can address them.
Well, Ira, shifting gears here, I'd like to talk a little bit about how the Media Access Group makes various different types of visual media more accessible to individuals that are blind or visually impaired. Can you tell us a little bit about DVS, what it entails, what it's about?
Sure. DVS is making the visual elements of television and film accessible for people who can't see. Generally, we get programs before they air, and our writers watch the programs, and they find where the pauses are, places where there is no dialogue or narration, and they watch what's happening on screen and really translate in words for the viewers. Mm-hmm. Once that script is generated, we hire professional narrators who then verbalize that script. We mix it with the program audio, send it off to the network where it is to air, and then it's broadcast and people get to watch that at home.
Can you give us some of the milestones that have happened in the DVS division since it began? I believe Mary told us when it began, but how's it grown throughout the years?
We were fortunate to have a gentleman, Dr. Barry Cronin, who was aware of a service for theater goers in the Washington area. And when television technology changed so that a separate audio channel could be broadcast to the home viewers, he came up with the idea of using that channel, using that technology to expand, if you will, our WGBH mission to reach those viewers. Mm-hmm. That was really the kernel of how this developed, through some funding through the Department of Education and some experimentation in those early years. The American Playhouse was a program that I believe was the first broadcast and became successful, morphed into what you might know today as Masterpiece Theater. So from one program that was described, we now describe a majority of the WGBH programming that goes to PBS. We also work with CBS. We also work with Nickelodeon. We do most of the children's programming that is on PBS. Mm-hmm. And we've gone from perhaps that one program to over 500 hours of television and movie program hours per year.
Mary, I want to get back to you now, and I want to continue with our discussion on DVS. Can you tell us a little bit about, for our viewers that don't know, how they can access DVS and DVS services from their TV?
Sure. As Ira mentioned, the description is broadcast via the SAP, second audio program, of stereo-equipped televisions. And most televisions that are sold and have been sold since about 1990 include the stereo feature. Unfortunately, the way you activate the stereo feature often requires some sight. As we know, there's a lot of visual menus that you have to go through on a screen now to activate various features on your TV set. But there also is a button on many remote controls now that come with TVs, and it has letters along with the button that say MTS, and it stands for multi-television sound. And basically that button, by hitting that, lets you scroll between stereo, mono, and SAP, those three options for getting sound, which makes it much easier to click on the SAP for a program you know has been described.
Today, a lot of folks have cable or satellite reception, and things are changing a bit so that within the cable selections, there is an option to turn SAP description on and off. We're actually considered, the SAP channel, or the cable companies do, as labeling it as Spanish. So if someone is having difficulty at home trying to access the SAP channel, try going under your cable selections, under the cable setup, audio, look for the Spanish selection. And very often that will be the key to turning on the SAP channel.
That's very interesting. So sometimes it may appear as just saying Spanish, but if you click on it, sometimes you get DVS, sometimes you get Spanish.
It's correct, because in the early days, before description, as much as we would like to think we're mainstream, I don't think we're quite there. Spanish is really synonymous with the general population as the SAP channel. We try and educate the manufacturers of these units to let them know that it's not just Spanish on the SAP, but it's a very large group of folks that want to access SAP to have audio description.
Well, so we've talked about DVS and television. I'd like to talk about DVS as it relates to home videos and DVDs. Mary, can you tell us roughly how many titles are available right now for individuals to watch movies in the comfort of their own home?
There are about 200 videos available now from DVS Home Video. Our windows for distributing some films may have run out. So, for instance, we negotiate with the various chains contracts to have a title or a group of titles at any one time in our catalog. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we're contacted saying, we love these new videos that you're coming out with, but we would love to be able to get The Godfather again, or my...
Right.
tape of such and such film has just bit the dust. Can I get this again? And unfortunately, those windows have expired. It doesn't mean that we won't renegotiate or won't be able to renegotiate for them in the future. Mm-hmm. But here in Massachusetts and New England, we have such a wonderful resource in the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library, because mm-hmm. they pretty much have in their collection every DVS home video that has ever been produced. And so folks here in this area can actually loan them from that organization. So that's great.
And would you say that that extends throughout the country, that most people, if they're interested in a DVS movie, should consult their local public libraries?
I would venture to say that public libraries around the country outside of Massachusetts, Perkins and the Worcester Talking Book Library, likely do not have as extensive collections as we do here, but that's not to say folks shouldn't try. I also hear from consumers that they can contact their local library, and if their local library doesn't have a title they're interested in, through an interlibrary network, mm-hmm. they can get them from another library.
And as you know, VHS is a dying mode of communication. We are hopeful that as we move to DVDs in the future, and the technology there improves, description will be carried on the mainstream product itself. It just every DVD will contain description. But I think we're a way off from there.
Everything that is published for home use is, for the most part, right now on videotape, as you were saying, correct?
With the exception of the most recently some notable titles, which I think Mary can
Universal Studios has been very proactive in distributing mainstream DVDs with the description track created for the theatrical or Mopix release.
Wow.
Just last week, The Inside Man with Denzel Washington, the DVD of that film was released in stores and online distributors such as Amazon and Walmart. And both the widescreen and full screen version of that DVD and that film are described. So there's a description track on that DVD. United 93 will be the next DVD that comes out with the description track, and that will be released on September 5th. There are many PBS programs, such as Nova and American Experience, that are available with the description track created on the DVD release. We actually have a page on our website that lists each DVD with DVS that is released. So folks can go to the dvs.wgbh.org website and get to that page.
I just want to say that this is coming about because of a lot of hard work from some of the people here at the Media Access Group, especially people in our LA division who work with the Mopix and the studios, and our marketing team who work to get this feature as mainstream, if you will. But what it really will take is consumer input, people saying that they want to see this audio description track on the DVDs. I think that is really what will drive it into the mainstream.
Well, you were just mentioning in the Mopix project, I'd like to talk about that a little bit. I mean, we've discussed home video, we've discussed DVD, we've discussed TV. These are all various forms of media where DVS can be found. Now, Mopix, can you, Ira, discuss a little bit about that project and how it all works?
I'm actually going to defer to Mary.
Okay.
Really, the Mary project.
Our Mopix efforts to make movie theaters accessible to people with disabilities, began years and years ago, actually almost as soon as we began captioning and describing for TV. We got letters and calls, this was before email, from people saying, "This is wonderful. I love being able to enjoy this or that program with captioning or description, but what I would really like is to be able to go to movie theaters with my family and friends and enjoy movies." So we began by getting a very small grant from the Department of Education to come up with some prototype systems for delivering captions to only people who need them in a theater. The major obstacle for delivering access services in movie theaters really is on the captioning side, in terms of delivering a closed caption stream to only someone who needs it that would not distract from the mainstream theater-going audience. Mm-hmm. Description could be delivered from the very beginning through headphones, because up until that point, headphones were used in theaters and actually by law required in theaters for as assistive listening devices. So the audio portion of a film would be enhanced for people who were losing their hearing. Mm-hmm. So that sort of technology and system was already in place. We could just apply description to that. So we came up with various options for delivering captioning in a movie theater only to people who need them. We had focus group testing here in Boston with General Cinema, which was the precursor of AMC theaters. Mm-hmm. And then we put the systems through their paces with folks from the industry, both studios and exhibitors. And we debuted the MoPIC system in late 1997 out in Sherman Oaks, California. And the first film was The Jackal, which maybe some people think is memorable. I'm not sure. But the second film was Titanic, and it stayed in the equipped auditorium out there, the auditorium that was equipped with rear window captioning and DVS theatrical for several months. And it gave a lot of people an opportunity to experience these systems firsthand, to see this wildly popular movie with their family and friends. And then it was just a matter of generating support by the studios and by exhibitors. And I hate to say flash forward because there is so much hard work on everyone's part, not only folks here and in the industry, but also consumers as well. Mm-hmm. But if you flash forward now, I think we're right about 300 systems installed across the U.S. and in Canada. And we have about 120 films released each year with captioning and about 60 to 70 with description. So we're working so it's equal. So every film will have both captioning and description, and we are making great progress there.
Yeah, that's what I would like to know too, about the motion picture industry itself. I mean, do you find that actual film studios are starting to realize the advantages and the benefits of spending, you know, the extra money to have DVS tracks made of their particular films or whatnot? Or is that still a pretty uphill battle, do you think?
It has evolved the way a lot of our work with these various industries, the various media companies have. Sometimes it's a matter of actually connecting with someone at the studio who really is interested in reaching an underserved audience, regardless of bottom line in terms of the cost or the revenue that will be generated by having those people in the theater. And then there are the ones that sort of are saying we'll do it based on the potential box office. If it's a film that we're going to release that we expect to be major, 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 then we will actually pay to have the film captioned and described. So it sort of falls into those two camps. Having said that, there are a few studios now that have committed for the past several years, and we know going forward, to caption and describe every single major release. And those studios are 20th Century Fox and Universal. So other studios such as Buena Vista and Warner Brothers and the Weinstein Company, these folks are all gradually increasing the amount of films each year that are captioned and described.
Excellent.
So we are seeing progress really on all fronts.
Well, I'd like to switch gears and talk about the third division of the Media Access Group, which is the National Center for Accessible Media. Mary, can you tell us a little bit about the mission of NCAM and why it's important for those with sensory disabilities?
Sure. NCAM came about because we had grown to a certain point in both the captioning and the description divisions of our access area here at WGBH, and we began to see a need to really keep an eye on the development of new media platforms, so new kinds of mass media, as well as existing ways media is delivered to people that were not accessible. So we came up with this new R&D division, the National Center for Accessible Media, which is really the third leg of the Media Access Group at WGBH. So you have the Caption Center, Descriptive Video, and now the National Center for Accessible Media.
Gotcha.
And we immediately began applying for grants, coming up with projects, areas that we saw needed attention in terms of being inaccessible to people with sensory disabilities. And we now are working on probably an average of 5 to 8 projects at any given time. Some of them last for a year, some of them last for 3 years. Some of them, interestingly enough, we have a window of time where we're being funded to work on them, but the funding ends, and yet that kind of media platform and distribution is just actually hitting the marketplace. So a lot of times we're kind of before, we're a little ahead of our time in terms of the research, and then we need to really work on getting the information about the work that we have done to make products and services accessible out into the industry.
So NCAM, for the most part, amongst many other things, is sort of the development arm of the Media Center.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things that have been developed through NCAM? I believe one of them was working with DVDs and talking menus. That's something.
Absolutely. We created the first talking menu for a DVD. Mm-hmm. As you know, operating a DVD, you need to go through a lot of on-screen menus. And we think people should be able to access description or whatever feature on a DVD they want, and they should be able to access that independently without sighted assistance. So we worked with producers of the American Experience here to make multi-part DVD, a multi-disc DVD called Abraham and Mary Lincoln, accessible through talking menus.
Right.
That was one of the first, and then we worked with Universal Studios to make How the Grinch Stole Christmas accessible via talking menus. And what we did, though, instead of sort of just leaving them out there in the marketplace and us retaining the knowledge, we actually created a set of developers guidelines how to go about creating a menu, and that is available free of charge on our website.
How about a couple of other programs that NCAM is currently working on, such as Access to Emergency Alerts Project and the In-Flight Communications Project?
Sure. Access to Emergency Alerts actually was a project that we proposed and was funded prior to the Katrina hurricane down in New Orleans, when it became so evident that not only, you know, the entire area of New Orleans and the coast of Mississippi were devastated, but within the news of the devastation was horrific news about people with disabilities completely being left out of the planning for the aftermath of such an occurrence, and also all the communications means by which people get their information about an emergency such as this.
Right.
We have funding from the Department of Commerce Technology Opportunities Program to develop ideal messaging. So whether you receive your information about an emergency, either man-made or a natural emergency, through the television, through radio, through a handheld device, through ham radio, etc., mm-hmm. all of this, what is the most important information and in which order that information should be in for people with sensory disabilities? Whether you are visually impaired or blind, whether you are deaf or hard of hearing, and for the very first time, one of our research projects touches on the needs of the population that is deaf and blind. So we held focus groups with the American Foundation for the Blind and the Helen Keller Center, mm-hmm. as well as several organizations on the deaf and hard of hearing front. And we gave people various scenarios, and we asked them what their ideal means of getting information through which devices and what information is most important to them. We will begin doing user testing with various devices and these prototype ideal message points this fall here in Massachusetts. But it is a national project that we know is dearly important to many people in the consumer community. Mm-hmm. You asked about in-flight entertainment.
Right.
That touches a little bit on the Access Alerts project as well. We think of the hours we spend in airplanes and the amount of video that's available now on those monitors that are over the aisle. Very shortly, we're all going to have monitors that are on the seat in back of the seat in front of us. So we'll be able to choose whether we want to watch a news program or an episode of our favorite television show or a movie. And the barrier becomes, number one, how to get caption and description onto the content that we're going to be able to choose between. And number two, particularly for blind and visually impaired passengers on planes, what the interface is going to be, mm-hmm. Making sure that the interface is accessible.
Right.
So that is a project that we have ongoing now, and it began years ago when an engineer who was working for Masushista Telecommunications, they are a division of Panasonic that makes those in-flight entertainment mm-hmm. systems. He came and visited us. His son is blind, and he wanted to make sure that the products his company was working for on would eventually be accessible to his son.
Oh, that's great.
So we're in the middle year of that grant now.
I'll tell you, so it takes a lot of long-term planning to get this done for, you know, a few years from now. It's just amazing how much input and thought has to go into it. It's
yeah, that's absolutely true.
Great that you folks are on top of it, I'll tell you that. Whether you're talking about the Caption Center, DVS division, or you're talking about the National Center for Accessible Media, Certainly there's a lot of wonderful things that all of you do as you come together here at the Media Access Group. So that brings me to my final two questions, which basically are this. If there are others out there, such as myself, that are listening, that want to continue to help your efforts in making all forms of media accessible to those with sensory disabilities, how can they help? Is there any way they can make a financial contribution directly to the center if they may, or are there any other ways in which you're looking for support?
Sure. WGBH and the Media Access Group is a 503C charitable organization, so folks can donate. Those here in New England, as well as folks around the country who watch PBS, are used to folks coming on their screen and asking for money. You can actually donate to WGBH and specifically request that your donation be targeted to the Media Access Group, to description, to captioning, to NCAM. And folks can learn how to do that by emailing me at access@wgbh.org, access@wgbh.org. Beyond that, we also welcome the input and participation of consumers. We often have perhaps online surveys about new guidelines that we're developing, or focus groups that we hold around our emergency alerts project. Mm-hmm. Just as important as financial contribution is actually brain power contribution by people telling us what's important to them, what is left not done, where they see barriers in their own lives and in the lives of their children or parents, and what they would like us to work on.
Mm-hmm. And I just would add that we also welcome comments from your listeners on the work we do in description and captioning. It's the way we can help improve our service and give that connection with the audience. As we talked about, whether it's someone who works for Matsushita and in-flight entertainment, or someone at a movie network studio, it's that one-on-one connection that often will take us to another level. So we really look for that personal human contact.
Very good. Well, we'd like to thank both of you very much. Ira Miller, Mary Watkins, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for all the work that both of you do here at the Media Access Group.
Thank you, Jason.
For more information about DVS, including a listing of described television programs, feature films available on home video, and more, you can call the DVS Automated Information Line at 1-800-333-1203. For those seeking information about DVDs with enhanced audio description, or for a listing of movie theaters with DVS services, you are urged to visit the DVS section of WGBH's website at dvs.wgbh.org. Additional information about descriptive video services can be found at Audio Description International's website, and that's www.adinternational.org. When we return, Brian Gould, a DVS describer, will join us. As we go to break, we leave you with a clip from the blockbuster film Batman Begins, featuring descriptive narration.
On the train, Ducard sweeps Batman's leg, then knees his face. As Batman recovers, Ducard takes a boxer stance and delivers repeated blows to his side. He ducks a swipe of Batman's bracers, then kicks the crime fighter down. Now, Gordon aims at a concrete piling, but blows up a ticket booth. The man in dreadlocks backs off. In the control room, a screen flashes red. On the train, Ducard pins Batman down by the throat.
Don't be afraid, Bruce.
Again, Gordon takes aim at the piling. One piling shatters. The monorail support sways.
You are just an ordinary man on a cape. That's why you couldn't fight injustice, and that's why you can't stop this train.
Who said anything about stopping it?
Gordon fires again. The top level of the elevated railway gives.
Yes!
Gordon pumps his fists. Now three rails come down, and the support tower tilts. Ducard stares as they rapidly near the gap in the rail.
You'd have learned to mind your surroundings.
Batman pushes Ducard onto his back. Outside, a monorail tower drops, shattering a building's glass and crushing a parked taxi.
You finally learned to do what is necessary. I won't kill you.
The crime fighter lobs a grenade backward. The blast separates two rail cars.
But I don't have to save you.
Batman swoops out the open end, and his cape catches air. On the train, Ducard calmly shuts his eyes. The monorail plummets downward, smashing through a boarding platform.
This is a public service announcement from the Audio Journal. The Lighthouse's Information and Resource Service provides accurate, up-to-date information about vision impairments, eye diseases, vision rehabilitation, and adaptive devices. You can find services to help you continue to be a productive member of society despite vision problems. Call the Lighthouse Resource Service at 1-800-829-0500. More than 30,000 people take advantage of the Lighthouse information each year. And just a reminder, all people age 45 and older should visit an eye care professional for an annual checkup, which includes tests for glaucoma, distance viewing, intermediate viewing, and reading. If you have a family history of eye disease, you may need to see an eye doctor more frequently. Again, call the Lighthouse organization at 1-800-829-0500 for a low vision specialist and other resources in your area. This has been an announcement from the Audio Journal.
While visiting WGBH, Jason had the opportunity to speak with Brian Gould, a describer for the DVS division of the Media Access Group. Considered to be the first stage in the DVS production process, the job of a describer is truly unique. With only 8 employed describers, the Media Access Group produces over 500 hours of video description for television and feature films on an annual basis. In this interview, Brian discusses the intricacies and challenges of writing descriptive dialogue, guidelines describers adhere to, and the skills one must have in order to be a successful descriptive artist.
Brian, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Brian, can you tell us a little bit about your position here at WGBH and how you got started with audio description?
I'm a describer, and I've been here off and on since 1996. And I began with DVS actually as a secretary. That was the beginning of my time at WGBH. And the job was described as watching TV and writing. And those are two of my favorite things to do. So I tried as hard as I could to get a job doing that.
Well, that sounds good. Did you have any background in journalism, writing, or anything else previous to WGBH?
I was a history major in college, and that involved an awful lot of writing. But the interview process was pretty intense in terms of actually having to do some writing and describing on the fly. There was a extensive training period, which I think takes about a year to become a really proficient describer.
Personally speaking, how many hours of programming would you say that you've described?
Well, over my time here, I'm not sure in hours, but in titles, about 450 titles, maybe closer to 500.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Can you please briefly explain the steps in creating a DVS soundtrack from the beginning to when it's finally produced and finished? Kind of some of the people that are involved with that whole process from start to finish.
Sure. Well, what happens is that I'll get a tape of the program and I will sit down and watch it. And depending on what sort of program it is, I'll watch it with the audio and video on. Occasionally I'll watch something with the screen turned off, so I'm just listening to it. Mm-hmm. So I really know where it's very confusing if you can't see any of the pictures. But in any case, I watch the entire program, and that's important so that I know which characters are important, what places, locations are important, and really what happens. If I don't know the story arc and what characters are important, I might begin a program and describe something like it's the most important thing in the show, and then we never see it again. So it's important for me to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I need to focus on or imagine myself as having never seen it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. I watch it, and then I start to write my script. And that takes anywhere from part of a day to a week, depending on what type of show and its length. And then from there, the show goes to a post-production supervisor or an editor, who's somebody else here on the DVS staff. Then it comes back to me, and we do a little back and forth, making really crafting the script. And then that post-production supervisor will bring it into a studio where there's a professional voiceover talent and an engineer. and they do a mix session.
And from there, then it's pretty much, you know.
Then it's delivered to whoever's going to broadcast it, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'd like to ask you a few focused questions on the actual script writing process, if possible. I had learned that there are several guidelines a describer hopes to or at least tries to follow when they're writing a script. And I'd like to cover a few of those guidelines.
Sure.
First guideline is research. Do you find that you do a lot of extensive research when trying to describe various visual elements and objects that are present on the screen?
Yes. That's just an easy answer. But the amount of research and the type of research really is dictated by the show itself. Say, for example, it's a documentary all about single-engine airplanes. Yeah. Well, then you know it's going to be detailed, and I'll need to know a lot about single-engine airplanes, which I actually don't know anything about, so I'd have to do quite a bit of research. However, if it's a show that is about water buffalo, say, but the scientists who are tracking down water buffalo are flying in single-engine airplanes, I don't need to be very detailed about that. I can think of a show we worked on, well, last year, but it was kind of a fun one called Eight Below, which is a movie about sled dogs in the Antarctic. And we had to, because the main characters in the film are the sled dogs and the people that's, you know, run the sled, we had to know all the pieces of the sled, the runners, what the different lines are called, what the different formations that the dogs run in. There's a fan formation where they're all spread out, where they're all in a line. So you'd be surprised at what we have to learn in this job.
I could imagine. So given the various subject matter, if it's subject matter you don't know a lot about, like sled racing, as you were mentioning, then you got to research the whole kit and caboodle, if you will.
That's right.
Can you over-research something? Is it possible to do that, and then you'll wind up having more problems with that if you know too much about something?
Well, of course, and that's one of the great things about having an editor, is if you have done that and you've put in too much information that, you know, your audience wouldn't know otherwise, except that you've spent the extra time and added details that aren't important to the program. If you sort of over-researched it, your editor is looking at it as if they were an audience member. And they'll come back and say, well, why is this detail in here? The show isn't about, you know.
Where do you pull your research from? What are some of the places in which you can conduct research?
A lot of our research is done online. We also have some very specific books. We have an extensive research library here in our office. That covers everything. We have some very funny books. One's all about facial hair. Any kind of beard you could ever think of has a name. All kinds of period clothing, you know, ships, cannons, castles. Anything you can think of, we have a book that describes it and has pictures and descriptions of all the parts of them. And, you know, we're at WGBH where they produce shows on just about anything, so you can often find somebody who works here who can answer your question.
So
pull them into your office and say, hey, what's that?
Oh, that's great. Well, the second guideline that I'd like to talk about is naming characters. Can you please discuss the thought process between naming and describing characters when they first appear on screen?
Sure. Again, even though I've watched a program several times before I sit down to describe it, I have to describe it for an audience member who's brand new to the show. So I have to often withhold the information that I know. So our rule of thumb is don't give a character a name until the name comes up in the soundtrack. So what we'll do is if this character, say, opens up on a, you know, young man in a pinstripe suit, and we follow him around for a few minutes before anybody says, hey, Bob, and we don't know his name is Bob, we call him the young man in the pinstripe suit. Now, it often or occasionally happens that someone's not named for a very long time. We know the character. The character's obviously one of the lead characters, but their name just doesn't come up. We'll do what we call force naming, which is come out and say the person's name, unless it's vital to the plot of the film or the TV show that we don't know his name. Maybe it's important that we don't know his name until somebody recognizes him. And, you know, so the rule of thumb is not to name someone before the show does. And that's a part of a larger rule of thumb, which is don't give any information that a sighted viewer would have. Don't give any more information. Our job isn't to over-educate the audience member. It's to describe what we see. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, blind people watch TV with sighted people, and you want them both to be having the same experience at the same time. If we were pre-describing something ahead of time when the action that we're describing isn't actually taking place, mm-hmm. even though there might have been a pause there, that's going to become incredibly disruptive to, you know, the sighted person who's watching it.
Yeah.
So we really, our goal is for the description to disappear, so to speak, for it to be so obvious and go along with the program so well that no one really notices it.
Mm-hmm. The third guideline that I want to talk about has to do with the tone of or vocabulary of a script.
Mm-hmm.
When you're writing a script, are there any guidelines that you try to adhere to with vocabulary in mind?
Yes, we always try to match both the vocabulary and the tone. I'll give you an example. If we're doing an Arnold Schwarzenegger action movie, we're going to be playing up the action with, you know, quick sentences, vocabulary that matches whatever the characters are saying. And you can imagine that's going to be different than we describe a show called Dora the Explorer. You've probably heard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a kid's cartoon. Sentences are going to be a little different. Vocabulary is going to be a little different. And that's part of the way that we can sort of make description the seamless process here, is that the narrator, while he or she doesn't sound like characters in the film or the TV show, the description blends really well.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have, you know, if it's a comedy, the tone is going to be, and the sentence structure is going to be different than a heavy period drama, for example, on Masterpiece Theater, mm-hmm. different from the action film.
I can imagine that writing a script that perfectly syncs up with a pre-existing soundtrack of a movie has oftentimes got to be challenging. What guidelines do you try to adhere to with respect to the soundtrack of the pre-existing movie?
Well, the soundtrack has so many elements. It has music, it has sound effects, and it has dialogue. And sometimes it has nothing. I can think of some Alfred Hitchcock films that I've described where at times the silence causes suspense, or it's left to let the audience member sort of think about what had just happened. You know, if there's a very intense scene, you'll notice often there's not much going on. First instinct for describers say, hey, great, there's no dialogue going on there. Let's fill it with a description. But we have to consider the director's intent. Is this a time for reflection for the viewer, or can I fill it with description? And, you know, music and sound effects can often say as much as we can with words.
Absolutely.
So maybe we provide a little guidance in there, but then let the soundtrack take over.
Well, you had mentioned something a few moments ago that was basically describe what's on the screen when it's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Makes complete sense. But are there times when the visual information is just so hectic that you can't describe what's on the screen when it's happening? For example, a lot of directors will use very quick shots to portray action in, say, a battle scene or a car chase, things like that. How do you as an audio describer keep the visually impaired listener informed as to what's going on the screen?
Well, you're right. In those cases where there's a lot of quick cuts, we can't describe it because it takes, even if it takes five words to describe an action, you're already three cuts down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So what we'll do is we'll watch a scene like that over and over to try and understand what's the arc of the action here. What's point A and what's point B and what happens in between? And describe it sort of in an overall general sense, and then to convey the speed and the action that's going on, maybe focus on a few things that happen. Say there's two battleships are out in the ocean, and there's pirates jumping back and forth between the two battleships and cannonballs and this and that, and maybe there's 50 shot cuts throughout the thing. But we'll say, you know, there's a big ship battle, and then describe, you know, one pirate swinging over on a line landing on the deck, and then a cannonball exploding into the thing, where we're not getting every single cannonball, but then we'll step back and say, and people duck under a volley of cannonballs, smoke rises, et cetera, giving both general and then, you know, dipping in and giving some specifics. And that's part of also watching, knowing what happens later on, because maybe something in those quick cuts actually becomes important later on, knowing what a specific action that might have happened.
Do describers specialize in a specific programming? Do you have a specialty, for example, You know, is there an audio describer that will just take dramatic films or programming, or another audio describer that will just take children's programming, or do you cover the whole gambit?
I would have to say that we all cover everything that comes in. Part of that is the reality of working on TV shows and movies. They come in when they come in, and they have to be. They're going to be on air very soon after we get our tape. So if you're done with your last show, you need to move on to the next show. Whether you know a lot about, you know, if it's a cooking show and you don't know much about cooking, well, you're going to be describing a cooking show. So you need to do a little more research. Mm-hmm. What it does is give everybody so much well-rounded information that, you know, before long, you really can work on anything that comes in. I will say that most describers do have their own personal interests and expertises, and that helps when you're working on something that you really don't know about. You can ask, you know, another describer. We don't all have the same interests, so that actually is very helpful.
And are there any traits, in your opinion, that you think audio describers bring with them here that really makes them effective describers, per se? Do you all have certain traits in common?
Well, so you have to love writing, and you do have to enjoy watching TV and films. And it is a production process, so you do have to be very wary of deadlines, because it would be wonderful to get a show, you know, say a great movie, and work on it for months and months crafting your description, but you don't have that. Mm-hmm. It has to be done when it has to be on air, and that's a skill that you absolutely have to have. So, you know, you have to be able to write, and you have to be able to do it quite quickly and very well.
My final question I have for you is there a particular program or a particular movie, project, what have you, that you've written a description for in the past that when you finally wrote that description, you sat back and you went, wow, now that is something that, you know, it took a long time, but I'm most proud of that particular piece that I put together. Anything stand out in your mind that you really recall?
Sure. There are things that I've written that I've really enjoyed. I can think of, I mentioned Hitchcock a while ago. I did the movie Psycho, mm-hmm. which almost every scene I sort of said, wow, that was really great. But, you know, you realize that it's, yes, I really enjoyed my description, but you're describing what somebody else has done, what a great director or, you know, a great filmmaker has created, and you've done your best to turn that into words. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of being very pleased with your own writing, but having wonderful material to work with. Mm-hmm. And that's when that happens.
Mr. Brian Gould, I'd like to thank you very much for stopping by today and giving us some insight on audio script writing, or script writing in general, shall we say, and it's been a pleasure.
Oh, likewise. Thanks a lot.
Worcester County residents seeking information about the extensive collection of DVS home videos available for loan at the Worcester Talking Book Library can call them directly at 1-800-762-0085. Additionally, folks living in the greater Boston area who wish to borrow described home videos can contact the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library located in Watertown. They can be reached at 1-800-852-3133. When we return, we will speak with Sheila Ray Lau, a DVS post-production supervisor. As we go to break, we leave you with a clip from the described motion picture Cinderella Man, the life story of legendary 1930s boxer James J. Braddock.
In a grainy, blurred focus view from Jim's corner, Bear rubs his head and shakes his arms down. Jim loosens his ankles with a little footwork.
One more round to go, folks. McAvoy stands at center ring, waiting for the fighters to join him.
Ringside, the timekeeper raises his mallet. The fighters move to the center of the ring. Bear seethes, his head and shoulders hunched forward. Jim's thoughtful gaze, aimed toward the mat, lifts as he steadily nears his opponent. As the ref brings them together, he holds a hand between them. Their leathery mitts come together. Bear throws a right and misses. Jim's punch connects. Jim evades a sweeping uppercut and left hook. Jim lands a jab on Bear's chin.
Stay away from him!
Jim lands a right hook.
That ain't laying back!
Braddock's corner is telling Braddock to stay away from Bear, because Bear is looking for the knockout.
Stay off him, Jim.
In church, the priest holds his dukes up. In the arena, Bear shoves a crouching Jim upright and wallops him. Jim punches Bear's already cut eye. Then both boxers trade head blows in rapid succession. Sporty gapes.
Thank you.
services for senior citizens with low vision. Individuals who are at least 60 years of age and who have low vision but are not legally blind can receive free in-home training and other services from the Vision Foundation in Watertown. Services include home management skills, appliance marking, lighting evaluations, reading and writing training, and support groups. The Vision Foundation also makes low-tech equipment such as lamps, magnifiers, and writing guides available at low cost and operates on information and referral service for product services and also other resources related to sight loss. For more information, call 800-852-3029.
Our final guest on today's program is Sheila Ray Lau, a post-production supervisor for the Descriptive Video Division of the Media Access Group. Editing the rough draft of a describer's script, engaging in constant fact-checking, and hiring professional voiceover talent are just some of the critical production tasks a PPS is responsible for. In this interview, Sheila talks about the importance of having an open mind when looking over a new script, how narrators are chosen, and she discusses the final steps in creating a DVS soundtrack and much more.
Can you tell us a little bit about your position and what it entails?
I am the second step on the production process. A describer creates a script for a DVS soundtrack, and then the script and the program comes to me, and I give it a second look and I edit that script and prepare it for production.
And how long have you been a post-production supervisor here?
I have been here as a post-production supervisor 4.5 years.
And previous to working as a PPS, were you a describer at all? Or?
No, I was actually an associate producer for Arthur. It's a children's animated children's series on PBS.
As you were mentioning, one of your main duties is to edit script that you get from a describer. Initially, has a person in your position seen the particular film, program, or project in question previous to reading through the script and starting to make some edits?
Usually, no. I like to start with the script and the film at the same time, having not seen the film already before. That way, I can let the describer's words form a picture in my mind before I see what it was he or she intended to describe. Just an example, somebody might say a desert, and then you have envisioned sand dunes and cactuses, whereas what you're seeing on the screen is a completely different kind of desert, the kind with mesas and stuff, you know, the southwestern desert. So,
Right. So
that tells me when I have pictured something completely different from what I'm seeing that we need to be a little more specific about what kind of desert.
Are there any other particular things that a describer may not have noticed about the script that don't flow too well with the initial film that it's been made for that you may pick up on as a result of having that ability to look at it from a fresh perspective?
Yeah, when we're working on, for example, a mystery episode where clues are given, a describer who has seen the film all the way to the end knows that, for example, the ficus tree in the background is important because we'll find out at the end somebody hit a gun in that ficus tree.
Ah.
But when I'm reading the script, they make it a point to describe this ficus tree in detail because it becomes important later. But not knowing that, the description of the ficus tree will stand out to me either, aha, that must be a clue because why else would we be describing this ficus tree when we normally wouldn't have, or I might think, that's a very odd detail to describe, and it just doesn't seem to make sense. Sometimes there's not a good way around that. Other times we try to blend in that description of the ficus tree in a seamless way as part of the action so that we're mentioning it, but you don't notice that we're mentioning it.
What about vocabulary? Do you ever find vocabulary, phrases that repeat, things like that, that, you know, maybe somebody such as a describer is so intimately into putting the script together that when you read it, you go, whoa, you know?
Yes, the describer is working with the written word. I'm working with the spoken word and with narrator. So as I'm looking at a script, I'm a little more aware of what's going to trip up a narrator or what's going to sound silly when it gets recorded. For example, the word grasps and clasps. Narrators just have a lot of trouble trouble saying those words, so I nearly always edit them out to something else. One time I was working on a show where the main character, her name was Frances, and her slave was teaching her to dance. And she was having a relationship with this slave, so she was very furtive about it. And we came across the line of description, as she dances, Frances glances over her shoulder. So we worked that a little. It's not something you'd catch when it's written, but the minute you speak it out loud, you know that it's going to draw some attention.
Obviously, I can see that. What about when reading a script out loud? Do you notice that sometimes if you're reading the description that the describer has written in conjunction with watching the film, things may not line up, or you may wind up reading over dialogue or things like that? You just can't fit things in where you'd like to fit them. What can you do to try to fix some of those problems?
It does happen all the time. When the describers are crafting their script, our computer program kind of tells them that what they've written fits into the space provided.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But when I'm editing the script, I make sure to also speak it aloud, because when you're reading something, it goes by a lot faster than when you're actually speaking it aloud. And plus, I also have in mind who will be narrating this particular script. Some narrators are very speedy, and some are a little less so.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I know that one of our slower narrators is going to be reading a particular script, I'm going to err on the side of shortening the description. If I'm reading it aloud and I'm hearing a big explosion in the background, it's not something you might have noticed as you were just writing the words. So
right.
I need to edit the script so that it works around the explosion. The script sets up the explosion, then we take a pause to hear it. Mm. Or I need to make a note to our mix engineer to lower the levels of the show during this explosion so that you can still hear it,
right,
but doesn't interfere.
And after you finish editing the script, what happens to it? It goes back to the describer, correct?
It goes back to the describer, or in some cases, the team of describers, and they look at my feedback, and they will either take my suggestions or they might disagree with what I've suggested. They've seen the film. They've watched it with a lot more detail than I have. I've seen it once. They've seen it back and forth and upside down. And sometimes what's just as likely to happen is they'll come to me and say, you know, I disagree with this edit because of this. And, oh, fine, I wasn't even thinking of that. Please keep it the way you had it. Mm-hmm. Or even more often, we'll create something different that incorporates both our concerns.
When all of the editing has been done and the post-production supervisor and describer or groups of describers have all gotten together and decided this is the final script, this is what works, what's the next stage in the process towards making this a final product, if you will?
I hire a professional narrator and book studio time to record the script. And we have a pool of narrators that we've been working with, many of them for as long as DVS has been around. They've been with us for 10, 11, 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
When we're recording and mix, our vision of the narrator is we imagine that our narrator is the person sitting beside the viewer on the couch, kind of slipping in their little tidbits about what's going on. We don't want our narrator to be up in front in the show. We want our narrator to match the tone of the show so that our narrator is not a distraction. We don't want to hire a dramatic, booming, powerful male voice for a children's show.
For instance, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood has an elderly woman. Correct?
Yes, yes. We have a narrator, Frances, who works very well with Mr. Rogers because she's an older woman and has a very gentle, friendly, grandmotherly voice. Mm-hmm. And it really goes perfectly with Mr. Rogers.
And are narrators given the finished script and allowed to watch the program so that they can rehearse, or do they just get the program or the description and watch the program and run cold with that?
No, they come into the studio and they go into their booth and put on their headphones, and that's the first time they see the script that they're working with. And it's for no other reason than efficiency. If someone asked me for a script ahead of time, I would certainly give it to them. It's just more efficient, though, to just show up and be up and running, and they're very good at what they do. And the same goes with the engineer. He's seeing it for the first time also.
Wow, that's really impressive.
Yes.
Think about, you know, that. I mean, you have an hour show or a two-hour movie. How many usual stops and, oh, wait a minute, I kind of flubbed that up. I mean, does it really go all the way through pretty regularly?
We have one particular narrator who prides herself in getting through a half an hour kid show without stopping. And when we do stop, she gets annoyed with herself. It is more typical, though, to stop several times. And it may be that a narrator flubbed a word. It may be that there was an error on the script, a typo on the script that caused a narrator to say something odd. It could be that the engineer missed a cue or didn't dip the show low enough and we were hearing stuff that was interfering. There are many, many reasons to stop. Sometimes we stop because I'm seeing something for a second time and I'm thinking, what we've written doesn't quite work. I'd like to make a little adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Roughly speaking, and I know that every project is different, but let's say from the time that a describer starts putting together a two-hour motion picture and writing his description for it to the time that the narrator finally finishes up with that, on average, how long does it take to complete that process for a two-hour film?
Well, a two-hour film would probably take, well, I'm going to guess, about six describer days. So it might be one describer working on it for 6 days, or more often where we've got some time pressure, so we might have three describers working on it for 2 days. Then it would take about a day to edit, and then a day to go into the studio. So if we had one person working on it at a time, it would be about 8 days to produce a finished soundtrack for a two-hour film.
Well, it certainly takes a group of dedicated people to get that done in an eight-day period when you think about all the things that go into it.
It does.
I'll tell you that. Well, in wrapping up here, can you tell us about anything that you're working on at the moment? Any particular programs that are happening today? Any movies that you're working on that we can expect to see in the near future?
Oh boy, can I. If any of your viewers have been watching Mystery or any of the adult programming on PBS, they've seen some commercials, some promos for the upcoming Masterpiece Theater series Casanova, and the promos make it look really exciting. I got my first peek at it on Friday, and I cannot wait for it to come out in the fall. It is wonderful, it's funny, it's very exciting, and I can't wait to start working on it.
Keep that on your schedules, and when it comes out, you've heard it here firsthand. That's obviously going to be a great show. So, Sheila Relisle, thank you very much for giving us some insight on what
you're
doing.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to Out of Sight XYZ, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Reading Network. We're here to serve people with print disabilities 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ira Miller, Mary Watkins, Brian Gould, and Sheila Ray Lau for their comments and insights about the outstanding descriptive video services they help provide. We would also like to extend our gratitude to the entire staff of the Media Access Group at WGBH. Their tireless efforts to make all forms of media accessible to everyone are not only commendable, but truly inspiring. If you have any comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.net. Out of Sight is heard on the second and fourth Tuesdays at 5 o'clock right here on Audio Journal. And on behalf of all of us at Audio Journal, thank you for tuning in and keep listening.